In the book of Matthew, chapter 26, verse 58, we read these words. Matthew, chapter 26, and verse 58. But Peter followed him afar off unto the high priest's palace, and went in, and sat with the servants to see the end. I want that to be a thought that you keep in your mind this morning as we look at the trial of Jesus before Caiaphas. And that is the statement recorded in verse 58 that Peter went in and sat with the servants to see the end. Jesus had told his disciples and the apostles more plainly exactly what was going to happen to him as the Son of God. Jesus had said early in his ministry, as recorded in chapter 16, verse 21, that I'm going to Jerusalem, and I'm going to suffer, and I'm going to be killed, but I will rise again on the third day. He said it again in the 20th chapter, verses 17 and 19, where Jesus said, I'm going up to Jerusalem. I'll be betrayed. I'll be condemned. I'll be mocked. I'll be scourged. And I'll be crucified. But I will rise again the third day. How plainer could anything be made than that Jesus knew that he would go to Jerusalem, that he would be arrested, that he would be betrayed, that he would be smitten, that he would be in every way punished and ultimately crucified. He stated it. He didn't couch it in parabolic imagery. He said plainly, I'll go to Jerusalem. I'll suffer. I'll be killed. And he didn't couch it in metaphorical language. Straightforward, plain statement of what was going to happen to him. And as Jesus made these statements, everything was going so well. People were being healed. People had been raised from the dead. There had been every sort of manifestation of his divine power as the Son of God that anybody might ever imagine or demand. They simply could not conceive of this man whom they had followed for these years, seeing all the power that he demonstrated to walk on the water, change the water to wine, and all of these things, they could not imagine anyone being able to capture him and kill him. So when Jesus made these statements about suffering and dying and crucifixion, they usually argued with him. The woman who came and anointed him with the expensive ointment may have had an insight into what she was doing, Mary Magdalene, because Jesus said she did it for my burial. There's no doubt there were people who believed Jesus because they understood the Old Testament scriptures that prophesied how he would suffer, Isaiah 53. But Peter argued with him and said, this shall not be true of you. Peter defended him when they came with staves and a great multitude to arrest him. The Bible tells us that he struck a servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And I believe he cut off his left ear, because this modern religious crowd that's always involved in liberal theology, they couldn't have possibly had a right ear, so they had two left ears. And that's what he probably cut off, was one of his left ears. And when this happened, when Jesus was arrested, and then he's going to be taken to Caiaphas, the high priest, the Bible tells us that they all forsook him. And this was according to prophecy, because it was stated that the shepherd would be smitten and the sheep would scatter. John the Beloved, we know, came to the cross with him. But what happened in the interim period, we're not aware. But he was there at the cross because Jesus committed the care of his mother to John the Beloved. But that's all we know about. There's no other information given in the Word of God. But Peter followed Jesus afar off. He went into the palace and he sat down with the servants where he could see what was going on because he came to see the end. I suppose that's what they all thought, that they had come to see the end. The end here is a word that means the fulfillment or completion of anything. So Peter came to see the end of the life, ministry, power, whatever that Jesus had preached and taught. They just came to see the end. But you know, oftentimes what we believe to be the end of the thing is really not the end at all, but it is in reality the beginning. And I think this is true of what happened here. This was the beginning of Christianity. This was the beginning of a new covenant with God that had been prophesied when Jesus took the cup and blessed it. So it was not the end, but it was the beginning. But normally we don't attach a beginning to all the bad things that were happening. We believe that beginnings begin with good things, and that beginnings never begin with bad things. And yet how many times have good things began with bad things happening to the people who are involved in it? You know, we talk about death and dying and sickness and poverty and depression and financial stress and all these things, and we look at them and we view them as an end. That is, this is the end of this. But it may not be. The Hebrew children were cast in the fire. I assume that's the end, don't you? But it wasn't. Daniel in the lion's den, I assume that's the end. That's what the leaders thought, wasn't it? That's the end. But it wasn't. It's the beginning. And when you look in the Bible, a lot of tragic things do not mark the end of life or the end of a circumstance. They mark only the glorious beginning of it. And I get the impression that people are sitting down to watch us die. That, you know, that's the end of Southwest Church. A lot of bad things happen. And bad in the sense of things we had no control over. And I rather suspect everybody thought, well, that's the end of Southwest Church. But in reality, it may be the greatest beginning or the beginning of the greatest thing that we've any of us ever witnessed. Okay? So to sit down in order to see the end of something when God is so involved in it is a mistake. And we can take people that we know who've died. And Troy told me Sister Gray had an aunt that died just last night. Well, that's the end of the life. It's not the end of her. You see what I'm talking about? The idea that we can look at these tragedies and just draw one conclusion from it, and that is this is the end. In many ways, it's not. And many times it's just the beginning. And that's what Peter did. He came to see the end, but he really saw the beginning of what we are involved in today as New Testament church. And that is in preaching the death and the burial and the resurrection of Jesus Christ as the glorious gospel of the Son of God that is the basis of salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Jesus before Caiaphas, the high priest. The Bible tells us that there was an assembly in verse 57. And they that had laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. They gathered together. And in order to proceed, they had to have witnesses. That's the first thing you needed when you're going to try someone in the nation of Israel at this time. You had to have two or three witnesses so that every word could be established, and they knew they had no witnesses who could prove that Jesus Christ was a blasphemer, so they sought for false witnesses, and finally they found two But they did not try to prove Jesus innocent. They looked for people who could prove him guilty. In verse 61, the Bible tells us and said, here's what the false witnesses said. I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. They said, we heard him say that. And he said it around the area of the temple. So we understand that he meant that he would destroy the temple and that he would build the temple again in 3 days. Now that's what Jesus said. But he wasn't talking about the temple at Jerusalem. The Bible tells us he was talking about his earthly body. And he said, you destroy this temple of my spirit, and I'll rise again on the 3rd day. So Jesus said what they said he said, but they twisted what he said and accused him of blasphemy. And that's oftentimes what happens to us, isn't it? And we say something, and we know what we mean. And many times our enemies know what we mean, but they twist it and use it against us to prove some point that causes us a great deal of harm and embarrassment. But with Jesus, the Bible tells us that they did accuse him. And in John 2, 18 through 20, and Matthew 27, 39 and 40, the people who passed by the cross say, well, you said you'd destroy the temple in 3 days destroy the temple in 3 days, you'd rebuild it. So this accusation stuck to Jesus. And they hurled it in his face even when he was hanging on the cross. And Jesus answered his persecutors. In verse 62, the Bible tells us that his inquisitor said, why don't you answer? You're not saying anything. I adjure you. And this word means take an oath or use an oath and formulate a reply. In other words, he's saying to Jesus, I want you to reply to me, but before you reply to me, I want you to take an oath that you're telling the truth. I adjure you. I implore you. Take an oath and swear your innocence or admit your guilt. And it's a very straightforward question. Whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. Now this was the issue. Whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. Have you claimed that? Have you preached yourself to be that? That's not what they accuse him of. The false witnesses say, we heard him say that he could destroy the temple or would destroy the temple and build it again in 3 days. That's blasphemy against the building that has been built in which God's Spirit dwells. But then they're asking, could he do it or how would you do it or why do you say you can do it? They're asking him, well, are you the Christ? Are you the Son of God? And all Jesus ever replied to was, thou hast said. And that angers these people more and more. But Jesus said, I'll tell you one thing. There are some things that you are going to see. You're going to see me sitting and you're going to see me coming. Not necessarily that these would be done in immediate order. No, he's just saying, look, you've said I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. Thou hast said it, but I'm going to tell you one thing. You're going to see me seated at the right hand of power. That's God Almighty. And you're going to see me coming in the clouds of heaven. Now, they may be separated by hundreds of years or 10 years or 1,000 years. But these are the two things that the Jews are going to see. You're going to see me seated at the right hand of God. And you remember Stephen did that. And whether that has anything to do with this or not, I don't know. But Jesus is going to come in the clouds of the air. And then all of the people who had anything to do with his crucifixion, every eye shall see him. So these people are going to do this someday, but Jesus just sort of passes from the present over to the future is what he's doing. You wouldn't believe me now if I told you I was the Son of God, and you may never believe it. But here's some things you will not deny because you're going to see these things with your very own eyes. And even then, seeing things with our very own eyes, there will be people who will still rebel against Almighty God. And then Jesus, the high priest, the council, When the high priest heard this, the Bible tells us that he rent or tore his clothes and accused Jesus of blasphemy. And he asked in verse 65, what further need have we of witnesses? We don't have to have any more witnesses. We've heard this man blaspheme. Verse 66, what think ye? They answered and said, guilty. Guilty of death. We've heard enough. We have been able to form an opinion by what the witnesses have said and by what he has said that we'll see him sitting at the right hand of power. He didn't use the word God. He said power. And then he said, you're going to see me coming in the clouds of the air. And they said, that's all we need to hear. We vote guilty. We vote death penalty. Then Jesus hears the council not only pronounce him guilty, but the Bible tells us that they spit in his face. Now, why did they do this? Why would they just come to him and spit in his face? Well, it's a sign of their representing God and that this man is a despicable blasphemer. It's not that they were just so irate and angry that they just decided to go spit in his face, but this really bears a message with it. We who are representatives of God are representing him by this act and showing all of the people what God thinks of this man, and so we spit in his face. The Bible tells us then that they buffeted him. That is to strike with the hands, the fingers being clenched, okay? If you clench your fingers, what do you have? You have a fist, right? So they struck Jesus with their fist, and others smote him, notice, with the palms of their hands. And maybe in your Bible there's a center reference there. But the phrase palms of their hands means to strike with a club, to strike in the face with the open hand. So literally what they did, they hit him with a clenched fist, then they either hit him with a stick of some kind or they slapped his face with their open hand. And when they did these things, they said, prophesy unto us, thou Christ, who is he that smote thee? So this is a taunting circumstance now. If you're Christ, the Son of God, then call the name of the person who smote you. You know, God's enemies have always demanded of his people that they do some spectacular thing in order to prove that God is with them, especially when they're in real bad circumstances. You know, they'd say, look, if you're not guilty of this crime that we have accused you of, then we'll throw you in the fire and you won't burn. We'll put you in the water and weight you down with rocks, and if God is really, you're really telling the truth, God won't let you drown. And so we can prove by this act that you're guilty, because fire will burn you and water will drown you. And our enemies always look for these spectacularly absurd things to prove one's innocence rather than to prove one's guilt, as they have sought to do. And it still exists today. You know, people say, well, if you people are really of God, where's your big building? If you're really people of God, where's your immense offerings? If you're really people of God, where's your big attendance? If God's really loves you and God's really a part of this thing, and how come you meeting here in a conference room in a Ramada Inn? If God is really with you, why don't you have this big church with stained glass windows, an organ, a piano, and 1,000 people? Why, God's not with you people. It's always what we call proving a negative. And you can't do that, can you? The idea that if God is with you, there'll be spectacular deliverance has happened, but not many times. How many times did David kill Goliath? One time. How many times did Israel cross the Red Sea? You know, one time. A lot of people got the idea that religion is made up of day-to-day extraordinary and spectacular things happening in the lives of people. But you may live your whole life and never see anything but cornbread and butter beans, okay? But you're thinking, if God's really with me, where's the golden chalice, you know? It's not always there. In fact, it's not there for everybody. You can have buttermilk with that too if you want to, or plain milk, either one. And then the Bible tells us that Peter denies Jesus. This may be the human interest story of the whole circumstance. They've arrested Jesus. They brought him into the chamber. They've assembled. They've accused him. They have found him guilty of death. They've spit in his face, buffeted him. They've smote him with the palms of their hands. And they've said, "Prophesy unto us, who is he that Christ? Who is it that smote thee?" Then, in verse 69, "Now Peter sat without in the palace." So we're getting to the accusation and the denial. And it's going to happen because Peter wanted to come and see the end. Whether he wanted to witness it as what we'd call closure in his life, well, go up there and see it happen, then I can walk away from it and just chalk that 3.5 years off as a dumb thing that I got involved in, which is really, if you can get out of dumb things you've done 3.5 years, you're pretty lucky, okay? No, I'm really serious. And Peter, if this was just a dumb thing and he got flim-flammed by a fast-talking Jew and he wasted 3.5 years of his life and he can walk off from it, it's sort of like, well, I'll just go up there and see the closure of this thing. See it out all in. I can tell my grandchildren. I got flim-flammed by a man named Jesus from Nazareth, and it all ended when he got killed up there in Jerusalem because he wouldn't keep his mouth shut. But the Bible tells us, "Now Peter sat without in the palace, and the damsel came unto him, saying, Thou also wast with Jesus of Galilee." Now notice, she just simply says, "Thou wast with Jesus of Galilee." In verse 70, the Bible tells us that he denied before all, saying, "I know not what thou sayest." Now notice how mild this is in the beginning. "I know not what thou sayest." In this statement, he's just simply saying, "I don't understand why you would make such a statement. I'm so far removed from that man that I'm just standing here open mouthed that you would even say that there is some sort of connection between me and him. I don't know who he is." The word deny means to disown, to say no, to refuse or decline. So Jesus, it isn't that Peter said, "Well, I'm not really sure whether I know him or not." What he does say is, "I don't even know what you're talking about." And then in verse 71, the Bible tells him when he was gone out into the porch, another maid saw him and said unto them that were there, "This fellow was also with Jesus of Nazareth." Now they had gotten up from where they'd been seated watching the whole trial. They walked out on the porch or the portico, literally. And this maid or this damsel, and you'll see the maid there is in italics, which means it refers back. So we still have a woman, a young woman or whatever, who's doing these accusations. And I've heard preachers talk about how these women were and talk about how painted they were and they were smoking a cigarette and wearing a bikini and all this sort of stuff. I doubt that, don't you? You know, they're always talking about the enemies of God, this kind of people, you know, that these terrible people are, you know, it's come out of the honky-tonks. You know, maybe she had been drinking and she's a prostitute off the street and she comes in, and, you know. Anyway, that's all kinds of silliness. You know what I'm talking about? Just absurd. I don't know what she was like or who she was. Probably a pretty nice person, okay? Probably a pretty interested person. Probably even an influential person. And she makes this accusation again out on the porch. "This fella was also with Jesus of Nazareth." And again he denied with an oath, "I do not know the man." The word oath means the object by which one swears. So what he's saying is, that Peter said, "I swear by my father, I swear by my mother, I swear by the Bible." He made an oath, okay, and said, "I do not know the man." Now the word "know" here is a mild form of knowledge, and it means I don't have a passing acquaintance with him. Okay? Really saying, I never met the guy. Now look, this is the same Peter that's been with him in the garden, you remember? And walked on the water. Intimately in contact, constant, 24-hour day, companionship, discipleship, apostle of Jesus Christ. And the first thing he says, I don't know what you're talking about. The second time he says, I don't even have a passing acquaintance with a fella. I'm really, really surprised that you would even suggest such a thing. I really do not know the man. And then there's the accusation. Again, after a while, they that stood by said, surely thou also art one of them, for thy speech bewrayeth thee. Now you'll notice in this accusation, and it's after a while, they came unto him, they that stood by. So we got a plurality of accusers now. And they said to Peter, surely thou also art one of them, for thy speech bewrayeth thee. And that's, just keep that, that's not a misspelling of betray. Just keep it in mind. The word speech here means the mere act of speaking. It isn't that Jesus said something about Christ. Well, I saw him raise somebody from the dead, and somebody said, oh, you must have been there then. You know, it wasn't a slip of the tongue that Jesus spoke, said, well, I heard him pray to God the Father in the garden, or I saw him raise Lazarus from the dead one time up there at Mary and Martha's house. It wasn't some slip of the tongue. The word speech here means a particular kind of dialect, or primarily a brogue, what we'd call a southern accent. So evidently what Peter had been doing, he was just standing around talking to him, passing the time of day. What do y'all think about Bosnia, you know, and you think, somebody said, look, you have got the same kind of brogue in your voice, accent, that I know you was with him. You come from the same place he came from. You know, sometimes we don't have to say anything, just talk and get ourselves in trouble, and that's really what Peter did. Thy speech bewrayeth thee. And that's two words. One of them means to make or to do, and the other means visible. So what they're saying is that your way of talking, not the words he said, but simply the way you're talking, has made it perfectly clear to us that you are a part of this man's body, his followers. Now, after the third time, there's frustration and irritation. Look at these. There's just sort of an increase in them. First of all, Peter said, I don't know what you're talking about. Second time, he said, I don't even have a casual acquaintance with a man. Now he's got to deny that he's ever been with Jesus in a very strong fashion. Then began he, that's Peter, to curse and swear. The word curse here means to utter curses against. And probably, and this is the only thing I can actually make reasonable, and the word is anathema, to anathematize. Who is Peter going to anathematize? Himself? Well, he could say, if I have been with Jesus Christ, then brethren, let me be accursed. Let me be separated and cut off from God. Or he could have placed this anathema upon Jesus. Now here's a man doing something that it's difficult for us to conceive. But he's uttering this anathema. Let him be accursed and swear, which is to promise with an oath or to declare with an oath. And what is it that he does in pronouncing the anathema or a curse upon maybe his followers, his disciples, or upon himself? It's still a very tragic and horrible thing he's doing. And then by an oath, he swears. And what is it that he swears? I know not the man. Now this wasn't no slip of the tongue that you can't hold Peter accountable for. I know not the man. I have no acquaintance with him. I have no intimacy with him. I have no knowledge of the man. I don't know who you're talking about. And then, of course, as soon as Peter had uttered this oath and had sworn by whatever he swore by that he did not know the man, you know what happened immediately, don't you? The cock crew. And Peter remembered. You know, many times it takes the little things in life to cause us to remember who we are and where we've come from and what's happened to us. We can get involved in things from day to day that take us so far from God that we are really surprised when we're brought back to reality by no more than hearing our own child cry in its bed or hearing the phone ring that this or that has occurred or just something that we never once even thought about being a wake-up alarm, a bird to sing, a wife softly singing in the kitchen, one of our children playing outside, and all of a sudden we just brought back to reality and realized what we've been overlooking and realized the price that we have to pay for that kind of ignoring what's it really important in life. What was important? What was so important that Peter had to lie, swear, to involve himself in just about every kind of crime you can involve yourself in, from lying to false swearing and being a false witness for which he could have been put to death? What really was at stake? Well, the ultimate would have been his life, and that's, I suppose, what he was afraid of. But again, we have to admit there are some things worse than death. And that's when God's people make concession from the truth of God. Amen. You know, that's where we are today. It seems to me that nobody believes that there's anything worth dying for. It seems to me that we all got the idea that there are things worth lying for, but there ain't anything worth dying for. And you know, to believe that there are things worth dying for has been the undergirding philosophy of our forefathers as Baptist people and our forefathers as American people. There were things worth dying for. The people banded together in America and said, there are some things that are worth dying for, and they weren't Cadillacs and four-bedroom houses. They were principles. These principles, I'll lay my life on the line for this principle. I'll lay my life on the line for this truth. And that's what Peter had forgotten, that his scrawny life was more of value than to stand true to Christ. And he made a bad decision. Because I can tell you that your life and my life and the lives of our children are not worth sacrificing principle for. And I'm not saying that without knowing what a price that is to pay either. But what do you see America believing in today that's worth dying for? Well, certainly not principle. Cocaine, alcohol. I mean, that the high that comes from that is worth risking your life for. That's what people are telling us, isn't it? That's what's happening, isn't it? That affair is worth risking your life for. That affair, fornication, adultery, sexual exploits, these are worth dying for, risking your life for. But principle, who? And this is sort of a joke. Who would die for a principle? And the answer is simple. God's people would. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Give me liberty, or what? Give me death. There are some things worth dying for. And Peter realized that later, but he hadn't come to that point of maturity yet where he could make that decision as sensibly and as solidly as he ought to. But I don't think you've become a man. I don't think you've become a woman. And I don't think you become a mature Christian until you have decided that you have a bedrock foundation of beliefs and principles that constitute your character as a human being, and that you are willing to give up not only some inconveniences that these might be carried forth, but you're willing to give up your very life for it. And that's what Christianity is. That's what's happened to bring us to this point in America, to bring us to this point in the Christian church, is people who were willing to die for what they believed that the Bible taught. But Peter remembered, because God had wound up a little rooster. And I don't know, maybe in eternity that little rooster had been wound up, but he crowed on time. And I'm going to tell you something else. Everything else in your life will crow on time. It'll not be early and it'll not be late. It'll be on time. You better listen to the roosters crowing. They may not be loud, and they may not be the invention of human beings, but I'm going to tell you what. In all of our lives, there are some roosters, and they're going to crow from time to time. And when those roosters crow, you better listen, because it's a wake-up call to who we are and what we've done and where we're going. And when this happened, the Bible tells us that Jesus remembered. He remembered the words of Jesus when Jesus had said, "Thou shalt deny me thrice." And the Bible tells us that Peter did exactly what any person who has any conscience will do when they realize that they have done wrong. He went out and what? Wept bitterly. You know, if Peter had lived in 1996, first of all, he would have said it was somebody else's fault, that it was his mother and father who had never really given him an opportunity. Maybe he would have blamed the government, said the rooster was too fat and crowed too early. Who knows? You know? But I can guarantee you he wouldn't have gone out and wept bitterly. He might have gone to the welfare office, or he might have gone to the psychiatrist or the psychologist, or he might have gone back to school. You know, to retrain. But I guarantee you, people today don't go out and weep bitterly, do they? Don't they find an excuse for what? And it really wasn't their fault. And I can just imagine Peter on his knees before God saying, "God, I don't understand how you could let this happen to a dear friend of mine." And I realized that I was not as truthful as I should have been, but Lord, you knew. You didn't expect me to run my own risk my own death by out here standing up against these folk. And now I hope you realize that we can all work this thing out to everybody's satisfaction if we just give it a little bit of time and get enough people involved in it, and we can finally just talk it to death. I don't think he would have gone out and wept bitterly. You ever wept bitterly? I have. You say, "Well, did you ever do anything wrong?" Yeah. You mean before you preach? Yeah, and after. You mean times you didn't say what you should have said? Yeah. Times you said more than you should say? Yeah. Preacher, you ever wept bitterly? Yeah. If I had all the roosters that have crowed in my life, we'd have chicken dinner today, okay? Right? I mean, furnished Colonel Sanders with a considerable oversupply, maybe. This is the way we grow. This wasn't the end of Simon Peter, was it? He came to see the end, but he not only saw Jesus condemned and set in the system to be crucified, is an end to Peter too, wasn't it? Because after this, what kind of person is he going to be? Going to be a different person, isn't he? Jesus said, "When thou art converted," and here's a man converted by a rooster. "When thou art converted," what? "Strengthen the brethren." Don't go after you have done this and you repent and ask God to forgive you, then get up off your knees and go to work. God's going to forgive you. Jesus is going to forgive you. God's people are going to forgive you. That's what Christianity is all about, is forgiveness. But if you don't weep bitterly, God isn't going to bestow forgiveness, nor are God's people either. As we look further into this that we've been studying, chapter 27, we'll see Jesus before Pilate. You know, Jesus was condemned in the Jewish court, taken to a Roman court, and there condemned, because it had been prophesied, cursed is everyone that hangeth on a tree. And if the Jews had dealt with Jesus there after the high priest's decision and the vote of the council, he would have been stoned to death. But he isn't stoned to death. He's taken before Pilate. We'll look at those things next Sunday.